Thank you. Well, good morning. It's a pleasure to be here in Paris. We not only have a nice place to have the conference, we have organizers that provide us with beautiful weather and even very entertaining Euro football last night. So what I'm here today to talk about is to give you a summary of what we've been doing at SNOW over the past year or so. I'm going to give a brief introduction to the experiment. I'll just talk a very short bit on some non-solar neutrino physics that we've published. I want to make a few comments about the salt phase of the SNOW experiment, which has come to an end and we're now analyzing the data from. And then I want to concentrate on the neutral current detector, or the helium-3 counters, that we have just installed in the experiment, and give you some details on this third phase of the SNOW. So just to remind you, experiment is located at 6,010 meter water equivalent underground in Sudbury, Ontario, Canada. It is essentially the key component of this is it has a kiloton of heavy water that is contained in an acrylic sphere that separates it from 7 kilotons of light water used for shielding. And it has around 9,500 photomultiplier tubes for the Cherenkov readout. Now, the key to SNOW, of course, was realized by Herb Chin, and that was that by having this deuterium detector, that one could actually see three different neutrino interactions on it. You can see the charge current interaction, where you have sensitive only to electron neutrinos. You also have the neutral current interaction, which breaks up the deuteron, and then if you detect this neutron, you can be sensitive to that interaction. And then you have the familiar from light water counters. You have the electron scattering interaction. And the big advantage of this is that you can take fairly model-independent ratios of the fluxes for charge current to neutral current, and also for charge current to electron scattering. And these give you key signature of neutrino flavor change. And one also can use, looking at the difference in fluxes day and night, one can also look for neutrino oscillations in that manner. And then finally, one can use the spectrum distortion information from the fluxes to search for neutrino oscillations. So the real key to SNOW is that this neutral current interaction, it's obviously very difficult to detect the neutrons to start with, but you also worry about any other background processes that can break up the deuteron, such as photodisintegration. And so since we know this is a very unique experiment, it's possible that there will never be another heavy water detector built. We actually, from early days in planning, wanted to try to do as careful as possible measurement of the neutral current interaction and of these neutrons. And so as we looked at things in terms of systematics, we actually came up with three phases of SNOW. The first phase, which was completed in May of 2001, uses just plain heavy water. We were able to extract a neutral current signal from the neutron capturing back on deuterium. That's essentially gives you a single 6.25 MeV gamma. And the nice thing about this was overall it was most sensitive to charge current, but we were able to at least get our first neutral current measurement result. The second phase of SNOW, which ended in past September, essentially enhanced the neutral current sensitivity to neutrons by putting in 2 tons of sodium chloride and using the capture of a neutron on chlorine. And now that reaction has some advantages in that it's higher, gives you higher energy in terms of your signal in the detector. It also has the fact that you observe multiple gammas from this on average, and so that actually is also an advantage for signal extraction. The third phase I'm going to tell you about today was started from the some time ago in terms of preparation, and that was that we really, these two phases both rely on the photomultiplier tube array readout, so you're looking at the light and the detector, we were looking for a completely independent way of detecting these neutrons. And so we came up with the idea of building proportional counters and putting this proportional counter array in the detector. And it's a completely independent detection system. And it gives you, unlike these two phases, event-by-event detection capabilities. And I'll spend some time talking about that, as I say, later in the talk. So this is kind of a summary of our measurement phases, where we took our first heavy water. We then took our salt results. And what I'll be talking about today is we've been going through this transition period of getting this detector array installed. We're right now in the process of recalibration. And we plan to run the helium-3 counters for essentially 2.5 years. And so the collaboration has decided that we expect that our statistical limit will be better than our systematics by the end of December 2006. And so that's when we plan to actually end the experiment. So in terms of publications, we have the publications from the D2O phase. We also, in the TOUT meeting, presented our first results from SALT, which is on a partial data set of about 250 days. And we essentially what I'm going to talk about today is that we've really, in the past, since putting that result out, we've had two simultaneous efforts going on. In terms of analysis, we have been concentrating on the full SALT data set, where we have another 150 days of data. We've also been simultaneously working on this transition from SALT to helium-3 counters. And that's actually was a fairly complex task. It required removing the SALT from the detector, doing a number of D2O calibrations just to check things, and then going through the helium-3 counter deployment. So in terms of the SNOW physics program, it's kind of summarized here. I guess one of the, obviously we were built to optimize for solar neutrinos, so the bulk of the program is under solar neutrinos. Where we've been concentrating our efforts is on the analysis, as I say, of the full SALT data set. We are nearly completed with that analysis, not quite done, and there's actually a detailed long paper that's in preparation, and we're hoping to have that out somewhere on the order, certainly this summer. We should have that SALT analysis finished. We also have a number of other efforts going on in terms of analysis underway, in terms of temporal variations of both solar neutrinos and other possible bursts, the HEP neutrinos. The antineutrinos, we obviously do not have the a very high sensitivity compared to, for example, CAMLAN, but we do have a unique signature. And we finished an analysis there and papers in preparation. We also have work going on atmospheric neutrinos and muons. And then in nucleon decay, we have a recent publication there. And I just want to switch from the introduction here and talk a little bit about that experiment, that paper. Basically, we recognize that if one has an invisible nucleon decay mode, for example, a nucleon going to 3 neutrinos, then you're going to leave oxygen-16 nucleus in excited state, and so you can look for these de-excitation gammas. You can actually go and calculate the branching ratios for whether you have this with a neutron or a proton, and you see that you would see a reasonable signal. And so we essentially did that analysis, and we have set lifetimes on the order of 10 to the 29th years for the neutron and proton modes. And when one, essentially the results here for the proton are about 10 times better than the previous results, and for the neutron we're about 400 times more stringent than earlier results. So let me now go and talk a little bit about the SALT phase of SNOW, just to remind you of why the advantages of it compared to D2O. For starters, the average energy that we see for neutrons in SALT is higher than for D2O, so there's that advantage. And then, of course, the higher capture efficiency on the chlorine means that you have a much more counts with the salt. And then finally, this gamma cascade changes the angular profile. And what I mean by that is that essentially when you have a capture, instead of having a single photon, a single gamma where essentially you would then have a fairly well-defined shrink-off ring, when you have multiple gammas, your isotropy of your event is much more complex, and so it's not just a simple ring. And so we developed an analysis technique based on this, this isotropy, which allows us to essentially discriminate at some level between neutron captures, which are represented by this blue californium data, where you have neutrons here, as opposed to the like a gamma from N16, or what you might expect in the red, this charged current data. And this isotropy parameter, essentially, I won't spend time explaining it here because it's in the paper. It's basically just based on Lagrange expansion of this angular distribution. I've included it for completeness in the talk. So this is the results we presented last September, and that recently appeared in PhysRev Letters. We essentially, using the analysis technique of doing a maximum likelihood fit to the various distributions with light isotropy, sun angle distribution, energy spectra, we essentially were able to extract these numbers in terms of the number of events observed in the first 250 days. And when you then go and do the calculation of ratios, you see that we see this ratio of 0.3 clearly showing neutrino flavor change. We then, applying this to the standard analysis techniques for neutrino mixing, where you have delta m squared versus tan squared theta, this is the combined analysis result where one uses the latest the salt data and the all the other neutrino experiments, solar neutrino experiments. And there, the significant conclusion is that you disfavor maximal mixing at about 5.4 sigma, which is somewhat interesting in terms of trying to understand the mixing matrix. The other conclusion is that when you combined it with the CAMLAN result, that essentially really only the large mixing angle area 1 or lower the lower mixing delta m squared was really favored. So now let me talk a little bit about the what we have been doing. In terms of the analysis of our full data set, we've really been trying to do careful characterization and calibration of the optics, the energy, our understanding our event reconstruction, the isotropy, neutron capture, backgrounds. I'm going to concentrate a little bit on backgrounds for a few minutes this morning. The difficulties is that we're trying to really map out our systematics here. Many of these effects turn out to be very interrelated, and you have to be careful that you've considered energy and optics when you're looking at isotropy, for example. As I mentioned, this forthcoming paper that we are right now winding up is going to include the flux as in our earlier paper, but it's also going to include two new things we haven't done with the salt yet, which we're going to have a spectrum analysis and we'll have a full day-night analysis. So at this point, let me talk a little bit about background, because backgrounds matter to us not just in the in salt phase, but all three phases. This is kind of a comprehensive listing of the backgrounds we've worried about. Of course, the ones that we worry about quite a bit in terms of the D2O is the amount of uranium and thorium that can be in there to give you certain backgrounds. Our goals are listed here in the sense of a few times 10 to the minus 14 uranium, a few times 10 to the minus 15 for thorium. To translate those into backgrounds, those translate to saying in your 1 kiloton of heavy water, you'd like your background to be about 1 neutron per day from such contaminations. And so that's the sort of the level that we've been striving to achieve. We've also looked at these other sources, and we have to worry about things in the salt, as you'll see. There's a few things we have to worry about salt we didn't have to worry about with the just pure heavy water, in particular sodium-24 activation, and also events that occur further out away from the center of the detector. And let me show that here. This just shows you the representative. This is a californium source making neutrons, radial position versus efficiency of detecting, of capturing a neutron. And you can see that this is for the heavy water phase as opposed to what we have with salt. And so you can see that salt, you go much further out radially. And so if you have backgrounds out where this acrylic vessel is or where there's other high energy gammas and things, you can certainly worry about the fact that you're going to be more sensitive to backgrounds. So we've done a number of different tests. I wanted to kind of highlight one, just one for you on the salt. And that's that we actually did a test of putting a spike of radon into the detector. This is count rate here versus time. And so you can see that we are going along and we put this spike in and then we actually made a measurement. The idea for this was we really wanted to try to understand our Cherenkov wall, our background wall. And also we want to understand the photodisintegration of neutrons. So here is a representative view of kind of what our detector backgrounds look like. This is a lot of data just to get you oriented. The acrylic vessels outlined our fiducial volume. You see this little hot spot we've always used as a calibration point. This is what we did. We essentially have a pipe that goes down to the bottom. We then inserted some of this this source. And you can see that what happened there was we put this in, we saw it without mixing, and then we did some mixing and we saw it decay away. So that allowed us to then do a calibration shown here where we fit both to the neutrons that were shown here in the fit, and then we also could fit to the Cherenkov tail at this point. And we were able to do a very precise determination and have a good idea of what our goal here was to understand this Cherenkov tail. Okay, so now let me switch to the final discussion on this on the third phase of SNOW, which is the helium-3 counters. As I mentioned before, we're really driven by wanting to do event-by-event separation, the fact that we want to have completely different systematic uncertainties, and we even have an advantage that by putting this in and removing the neutrons, it means that in the PMT signal, the charge current actually is a little bit cleaner, so we can do better on the spectral shape there. The reaction, as I've mentioned before, is shown here. The two advantages to this is that one of the things about having an independent readout system, an event-by-event readout, is we can really break correlations that we have in the D2O analysis and in the salt analysis. And you can imagine why we have these correlations. You know, we're essentially constrained in our fits that we have to kind of sum up to the total number of particles here, and as we're doing these, we're not doing it event by event, but we're doing it overall distribution, so we have a charge current and we have the neutron distributions. And so you can see that we actually, in the heavy water and in the salt phase, we have fairly large correlation coefficients. But the real advantage of these helium-3 counters is the fact that we do event by event and we have essentially zero correlations. The other issue has to do with trying to improve our overall measurement. With the neutral currents, we can actually do this neutral current charge current ratio. With the helium-3 counters, we think we can get about a factor of two precision over our current limits. And just to give you an idea of what that looks like, it's shown here. And so we basically think we can get this factor of two, and it really narrows down our sensitivity to the mixing angle region. We can do a similar improvement on day-night in terms of our statistical sensitivity there. We can probably get to about 3% absolute. Obviously, this is not going to be as competitive as what one can do with CAMLAN, we know, but it also is nice and it gives us a very nice consistency test. One of the interesting things we're going to start seeing here is we're going to see if these experiments are consistent amongst themselves. And of course, there's also the fact that one other advantage of being more precise is that in three neutrino mixing modes, one can help constrain the theta-1-3 as well. So now let's talk about how we get to the to this. Of course, before we can start putting the helium-3 counters in, we have to get the salt out. This is just a plot showing the water groups monitoring of salt. We were trying to get to a goal of around a part per million of salt, taking the 2 tons out, and you can see that we did that in a month, which is exactly what they expected to happen. Now, the other thing that happened with salt that was quite interesting was we had a problem that when we went to salt, we saw, this represents the energy of the N16 source, we saw that we essentially have a trend here, but we had a sudden abrupt change and loss, essentially loss of light. And at the time, it was impossible to unfold the cause and to be 100% certain. We thought it might be the salt, but we couldn't tell. So here is one of the possible manganese essentially particulates, and those are a potential problem. And so here's a plot versus time as we took the salt out, and now here is the light in the detector. So you can see that as we took out the salt and this manganese, the light went back up, and actually was where we expected it to be. Okay, so now let me talk about the array, the helium-3 neutral current detectors. This was actually a really enormous, essentially, process. It's been going on for nearly 15 years. We started with R&D on counters. We had to come up with counters that would be pure enough to put in the ultra-clean heavy water. We, in fact, developed a new process for these bodies. So we came up with a design that has a very ingenious way of anchoring it. At the same time we were working on this, we needed to figure out how to install these counters, because you can see if you have 11-meter counters, you can't quite get to the top here and just put them down the neck. So we had to come up with a very complex and careful way of doing in-situ laser welding right above the neck, where we would then install these. We also had to, early on, develop the anchors and put where these anchors were going to be in place while we were doing construction. We also had to develop a submarine to allow us to fly these into position. Then once we kind of had that, we had to go through the construction process, and we managed to, in fact, build detectors that are about 500 times better than any of previously built detectors. In terms of the readout, when you first look at this, this is where the helium-3 and P is, here and down here. You see that the bulk alphas give you a background, and that would look like a problem, but we also worked on pulse discrimination techniques, so we can actually use rise time information, and we can actually get a completely clean area that's background free. So we worked in that phase and in the data readout. We worked, after we had done the D2O measurement, of re-optimizing the array and deciding how best to be most sensitive to neutral current detectors and also to neutral current and to charge current. And then finally, we moved into, we took the array, we actually put these underground to let them cool off from the cosmogenic activity. So they were there several years. Pre-deployment activities, we actually could do quite a bit of welding, so we would minimize the amount of time that it took to build the counters during the final deployment phase. And that's shown here, and again, it's a very complex task. You can actually see, we'll have a poster on some of this. You can get much more details. But we have a global view camera that allows us to watch things. We have a pulley system to put things down. We then have where we fly this around. And I'm just going to kind of end up by showing a few pictures of things. This is a, we had to take apart, this is a glove box on top of the neck of the vessel. So we had to kind of first disassemble. And then we started assembling. This is a deployment plate here, and the reason it's where kind of the interface, and it kind of shows you the sorts of problems you get into, because you can see what that looks like. When we first got the shipment of it, this is what it looked like, and we were very confused as to what it was. And we then started, once we figured out what it was, we got pretty worried about what the person who had this plate was doing, because it turns out that this was an Italian car hood that had been misshipped to us. We were worried the guy was driving around with our deployment plate. So now here is we're lowering the ROV into the water. Here is a counter. This is construction going on. You can get an idea of being handled in a clean situation, getting ready to insert. Here is actually the counter getting inserted and preparing a laser welder. And here is one of the graduate students. Graduate students are the best drivers, who's flying the ROV. And let me show you quickly, kind of ending the movies here. What you're seeing here is a view from the global view camera. You've got the ROV, you see there's the NCD helium-3 counter. You're driving around. This is a view on the ROV submarine. You're actually seeing the very bottom of the counter, the attachment that's going to go into the anchor point. And then as we come up here and as we're flying by, we're actually looking for these little anchor points, which are quite hard to see. You can occasionally see them as we fly by the ones we're not going to anchor in. And as we go along here, you will see in just a second from down here in this view, you'll see that we will fly by a attachment point that we're not going to use. And then this coming into view here is the tether. This essentially is the umbilical cord that helps us control it. Here's one that we're not going to. You can see they're very difficult to spot. And the one we're going to ends up being right there. And what you'll see here as we go to it is you will see that we eventually come into view of it with this camera. And as we do so, you'll notice there's a little tag on it. So there's a little ID, a nickel tag, that allows us to read off and make sure we're at the right point. This is actually I1. And now we're going to use this little clamp. So you can imagine this little ball is just going to be kind of put in and clamped into this anchor point right here. And we're done. So it's really simple. Okay, so now this is my last slide, and I will just give you a summary. Basically, we have completed the installation of the 40 helium-free strings. We have about 398 meters. We're essentially now recalibrating both the PMT system because there are some changes to the optics, the light optics, and we're also calibrating helium-free systems. And the bottom line is that we are going to run in this for 2.5 years. We expect, if things go right, that we're going to reach a sensitivity about twice that of the present SNOW result. And so I'll end by once again acknowledging all of my collaborators who have played such a role in getting this together. It's obviously been a very intensive time for us, and thank you for your attention.
Good. We have a few minutes for questions. Would anybody like to question or comment?
Just, if you measure the delta m squared and the independent Kamland would measure it, you might have a maybe not so stringent test of CPT in neutrino sector. We don't know anything about CPT, I think. But it maybe is lousy, but better than nothing.
Yeah, if there was some, it's given where the data is right now, you would. It's very unlikely. I mean, you saw the overall size of that uncertainty. It would have to be some change from where we are currently, and it would have to be a very large effect, but you never know. But I think it's not very likely.
But we don't know anything. Yes.
Well, what we do know is we know the first Kamland results, and we know the overall where the solar neutrinos are, so we know there's some consistency there, but you're right. But the nice thing is once you've done more of these, and you've gotten it narrowed down, we'll see if they're consistent. Yes.
Excuse me. When do you plan to release new data on the SALT? And second question is, I thought you were planning to have between the SALT and the counterface some part where you will check if you find again the previous result before the SALT. So you abandon this idea?
Yeah, so let me answer the second question first, which is that we had not planned to try to redo the entire heavy water measurement because it's not really the optimum way of doing it. It turns out that the best way if we have of measuring the neutral current, getting our best result, is using the helium-3 counters. The reason we decided to go with SALT first and then with the helium-3s was because it was a lot easier to put the SALT in and take it out and then put the helium-3s in. So the thing we had been planning, which is maybe what you're thinking about, was we did want to go back to the pure D2O phase and do some calibrations, for example, the optical. So we did do that. So we actually do have a month or so of data where we did intensive calibrations with the pure D2O just to make sure that the detector was very similar to the state we had it in prior to SALT. So we did do that. In terms of your other question, is we are very, very close. We're nearly finished with the analysis. And the paper, it's a very long paper, like 30-plus pages. We really wanted to try to get all of that in there, and we were hoping to get that out and on the order of a month or so. So I think it's very likely it'll come out this summer.
Okay. Thank you very much, John. And,